The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
This week, we're interviewing a guest from Harvard, Associate Professor Michael Norton. He's also the co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, where did you get the idea of writing this book on smarter spending? What's the trigger points? What led you to put pen to paper?
My co-author, Liz Dunn, and I were both, we met when we were in graduate school, and therefore we met when we were completely broke. And we then subsequently got lucky enough to get jobs and have an income. And because we're nerds, we looked around to see, can anyone tell us what to do with this income to make ourselves happier? You know, what should we do now that we have a little bit of money? And there were many, many books on investing and saving, and those things are all important, but there was very little on what to actually do with your money to make yourself happy, to increase your well-being. And that was really the trigger point. We said, maybe we should do some research and find out what are the ways that people can use their money to maximize their happiness.
So, you know, would you describe this as a problem in a developed economy like the United States, where, you know, pretty much about half the country lives from paycheck to paycheck? You know, money is a source of immense stress. So how do you turn it into something that makes you happy?
It's very, very difficult, in part because even people who don't have much money tend to use the money that they do have in ways that don't maximize their happiness. So the book is not necessarily for wealthy people who need to decide, you know, which island to buy. It's really for everyday people who are thinking, what should I do with this $5? So just as an example, we see that many, many people spend an enormous amount of money on coffee. They buy a coffee every single day, and a coffee is only a few dollars, so why not buy a coffee and treat yourself every day? But if you spend a few dollars on coffee every day, over the course of a year, you're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on coffee instead of perhaps on something that might actually make a difference in your life. It's not that coffee is bad. It's just that we tend to focus on specific purchases instead of on our money overall, and we waste money on things that don't make us happy.
So the book's been really well received. I just had a quick look up on Amazon today. It's ranked number 2 in the Kindle store for mental health under the emotional section, mm-hmm. and under consumerism is in the number 3 slot. So that's done really well. You know, what's the feedback you've had from the average Joe, the average consumer, in respect to this concept of controlling my spending, not buying a coffee so that I have some other opportunity in the future, for example?
I think people find it useful. Some of the principles people will feel as though they're aware of them, but they just haven't been putting them into practice. So, for example, one of the things that we tell people to do is buy experiences instead of stuff. And it's not as though people never buy experiences. Of course we do. We go out to dinner and things like that. But it's this reminder, when you're buying any one thing, am I actually using this money in a way that's going to maximize my happiness? Or should I take just a second and think, maybe I don't need stuff, maybe I should buy an experience instead? So it's really, the feedback that we get is from people is it helps with a lot of little decisions every day, changing slight things in how you use your money, but those can really add up to more happiness over time.
Now, you know, we do have a bit of an endemic issue in terms of spending, primarily because we don't get a lot of visibility on our spend. You know, when we're at a store and we pull out a piece of plastic, you know, the context of that money or that spending decision we're making at that store, like you likened the buying the coffee, you don't really see the impact of those small everyday decisions adding up. So, you know, how do you coach someone to get better visibility on the impact of those smaller decisions that add up into, you know, a bigger overall trend or impact?
It's very, very hard. And if you think about, we have the same problem with lots of things in our life. So, for example, any one piece of pizza that I eat isn't going to do much to my weight. But if I eat one piece of pizza every day, it's going to start adding up to my weight. So we often have these problems where any one thing that we do doesn't seem to make a difference. And we rarely aggregate across all of our behavior to think about how are we actually spending our money or how are we actually eating over time and how is that going to affect us in the future. We've actually been working with a bank to think about, you know, when you get your credit card statement, sometimes it's broken down at the end of the year into different categories. But in general, it's just a list of things you bought in order of the date you bought them. Imagine right. if your credit card bill instead was sorted into categories that you chose that you were trying to monitor. And then you could see every month, wow, I really spent a lot of money on coffee this month. I had no idea. Maybe I should shift it into this other category that might make me happier. So when we get feedback about our behavior, like in monthly summaries, it often doesn't give us, as you're suggesting, a sense of what we really did. It's just a list. But we could help right. ourselves by organizing those things into ways that teach us about who we are and what we did.
So you mentioned before sort of choosing experiences over things, but you also have five principles in the book. So tell us about what those five principles are and what they mean to this this overall concept of happy money.
Sure. So the very first one is, in fact, stop buying stuff as much and start buying experiences. For many reasons, when we buy experiences, we look forward to them more, and anticipation is good. When we're having an experience, it's more interesting than when we're, for example, watching TV by ourselves. And when we look back on experiences, we have better memories of them than we have about the time that we bought that TV. So overall, experiences pre, during, and post are actually better than stuff. That's the very first one that we identified. The second is what we call buy time, which means if you think about how you spend your money, we very often use it in ways that don't make our time any better. The example that we use is we buy an enormous house in the suburbs, which is a beautiful home, and we forget that we're also buying a two-hour commute every single day for the rest of our lives.
Right.
When you think about that, is it really a good use of your money for your overall happiness when you're buying yourself a commute, which is the worst thing for happiness that humans ever do? Again, you just have to maximize your happiness overall with your money rather than getting focused on this house is good, therefore it will make me happy.
Yep.
The next principle that we talk about is actually related to our discussion of credit cards. We call it pay now, consume later. And credit cards encourage us to do the opposite, which is consume now and pay later. So I can swipe my card and get anything I want right now. I can download an album online. I can get my coffee immediately. And then the bill doesn't come due for much, much later. That's not good for us because when you pay now, you don't have to wait for things. And waiting is good because it gets you excited about what's coming. And when you pay later, you have debt and you worry about your debt. We tell people to do the opposite, which is pay now. So pay for things up front before you have them and then consume it much, much later. And one example of that is paying for your vacation months before you go in full and then going on the vacation. And by the time you get there, it feels completely free. Mm. As opposed to it's on your credit card and every single thing you swipe on your vacation, you feel the pain of paying all over again.
Yeah, that's cool.
Next principle is called make it a treat. This one is very, very hard for us to do, and by us, I mean me, because it involves giving things up that we like a lot. So to use coffee as an example, if you're somebody who loves to have a latte every single day, you're going to get tired of it. Even the very best things in our lives, it's sort of the curse of being human, is we get tired of things. Even the very best things, we get a little bit tired of them over time, and the way to get excited about them, again, is to give it up for a little while. So if you take a week off from coffee and you come back next Monday, you're going to love the coffee even more. If you watch TV shows all the way through every episode, they're still good, but you're getting tired of it. Whereas if you take a week off, you're going to enjoy it more. So making things a treat actually involves spending less money because you're giving things up, but actually allows you to get more happiness out of your money.
Right.
And then the very last one, which is a lot of the research that Liz and I have done together, is on an even more radical change in spending, which is rather than spend your money on yourself all the time, try just occasionally to spend it on somebody else. So buy a gift for a friend or donate money to charity or help a homeless person. And we've shown time and time again that on average, spending on yourself doesn't do much for your happiness, but spending on somebody else reliably increases people's happiness.
Very interesting. So, this concept, of the way we spend money is pretty critical. But one of the problems we have societally is that, we can just have this impulse to buy something, and credit is there ready on tap. So, how much of this do you think, in terms of really getting control of our financial happiness and our financial health, how much of it is getting more planning in our spending rather than the impulse side of things, which that credit, easy access to the credit card there. What can we do about that impulse factor to put it something that's maybe more planned and more predictable? Is that part of the secret?
It absolutely is. I think as soon as we start thinking about what we do with our money overall, and you see, in fact, how you spend your money overall, it's funny because we're spending our money on things that we want, so you'd think that we know how we're spending our money. And yet we don't. Often people are very surprised when they see what percent of their money goes to different expenditures. We're aware of it on some level, but it's not visceral to us how much we're spending on X and Y compared to the things that we actually wish we were spending money on. So I do think that showing people what they do can help them to plan better how they spend going forward. But the other part really of what we're saying is there's so many books, and many of them are fantastic, on that you should spend less and save more, because it's better for your long-term happiness. And we, of course, absolutely agree that saving is a fantastic thing to do. But that's like telling people basically, look, I know that you love to eat food, but don't eat any more food.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard for us to do because, unfortunately, we're human. So when we know things are good for us, we can try to do them, but then we'll slip. And one of the things that we're trying to do in our book is basically tell people, you're human and you want to use your money. You worked hard for this money and you want to use some of it for something that you like. When you're in that mindset, at least use it on things that will actually make you happy. Hopefully you're saving at the same time, but at very minimum, when you spend, don't spend it on things that aren't going to do anything for you. Spend it on things that really will increase your happiness.
Right. So I'd like to have a quick break, Michael, and after the break, I'd like to come back and talk about some of the stuff you're doing at Harvard and a little bit more about the happy money movement.
Sounds great.
All right, we'll be back after the break. You're with Brett King on Breaking Banks and our guest, Michael Norton, the co-author of Happy Money and an associate professor at the Harvard Business School. Back right after the break.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. The experts are here. Voice America Business Network.
Dialogue is the single most powerful leadership tool we have to make a difference in the world. Leading Conversations with host Cheryl Esposito creates a place for that dialogue. Tune into the Voice America Business Channel every Friday as Cheryl hosts new conversations among leaders from around the world in business, government, art, economics, and social change. We'll explore big ideas and everyday actions and learn how their own leadership has led them to discover a newfound sense of possibility in the world. Leading Conversations with Cheryl Esposito, bringing big thinkers together in conversations that make a difference, right here on the Voice America Business Channel, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Weather whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King, your host, and we have our guest today, Michael Norton, an associate professor at Harvard Business School and a co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. So, Michael, before the break, we were talking about the book and some of the principles in it. Tell us about the work you do at Harvard and, you know, the broader movement behind this and what you're trying to do systemically.
I think we talked before the break about how individuals can change the way they spend their money to make themselves happier. And hopefully we've identified a few ways that people can shift their habits to get more happiness out of their spending. But part of what we do as well is work with companies. So if you think about, if we have some insight into what makes people happy when they spend their money, can companies use that data and that knowledge to change the way that their customers spend their money so their customers are happier, and change the way their employees spend their money so their employees are happier? So we're trying to think broadly about how can organizations encourage their key stakeholders, like their customers and their employees, to, when they spend their money, they get more out of it, and then hopefully they reward the company that let them do that, so customers become more loyal, or employees work harder and reward the company with better performance.
Okay, so, you know, tell me about some of the companies that you're working with, or some of the organizations that you're reaching out to.
So one example, we talked about the benefits of spending money on other people instead of on yourself in terms of your happiness. As a company, if you're aware of that, imagine, and we've done some research like this, imagine that you get in the mail one day from, for example, Crate and Barrel, who's an organization that we've worked with, and you're used to getting things that say, here's $50 off your next purchase. That's what retailers generally send us.
Right.
Imagine you get from Crate and Barrel one day a voucher that says, here's $50 to give to charity. Thanks for being our customer. Here's $50 for you to give to charity. And by the way, the charity is a nonprofit called DonorsChoose.org, which allows public school teachers, primarily from low-income towns and cities, to post projects that you can fund directly. So someone could say, I'd like a microscope for my students. My school district can't afford it. And you and I can go on right now and buy it for them. And then the kids send us thank you notes and say, thanks so much, we love doing science. Crate and Barrel sends me a gift certificate to Donors Choose, and I can go on and help kids, thanks to Crate and Barrel. Now, that's an enormously different model of how to deal with your customers than here's $25 off if you spend $100 or something like that. Absolutely, customers respond to discounts and things, for sure, so it's not as though that's an incorrect strategy. But think of the change in dynamics between a company. If they're allowing their customers to do good in the world, will their customers then come back and reward them with more loyalty?
Now, I want to tell you a bit of an experience that I had. You know, I have a business in Hong Kong, so last week I dropped into Hong Kong, and one of the things I do is I check my mailbox. And, you know, it some months can go by before I can get back there, but this time, you know, I checked my mailbox, and without exception, all of the mail that I got was from financial service companies.
Uh-huh.
And about 30% of the mail I got was offers from my, you know, financial service companies that I work with, banks, basically encouraging me to spend more money on my credit card in order to get rewards. Now, we have this systemic system in place right now, it appears, cash back on your spending, rewards on your spending, and the system is really geared towards, you know, people spending money more and more. So how do we fix that? How do we fix this systemic approach where banks are incentivized to get you to spend money regardless of whether it's healthy or happy, you know, money spend?
I think it's a very, very difficult question to solve because, of course, banks can make money if we spend. I think that some banks increasingly now are thinking more about customer management than short-term profits, but I think it's a very slow shift in mindset. So you can imagine banks thinking about, rather than sending credit card offers a million out every year, what if we think about our customers we have? What if we help them become better customers? And that's good for those customers themselves because they're being better with their finances, but it also can be good for the bank because they can upsell on other products that actually are high margin for them. It's a very long view of how to manage customers. Most industries, that doesn't happen. But you can think about banks, and we've talked to a few that are really thinking about how can we help people spend their money in better ways, given that they're going to spend it. At least let's help them spend it in better ways. And then maybe they'll be our customer in the longer term, and we can actually help them and make more money.
Yeah, I mean, it concerns me that we and it's sort of happened slowly over the last 30 or 40 years with the credit movement. But to use your analogy, in terms of the decision making process and so forth, and the pizza thing, it's like going to a doctor who says, "Look, I'd love to give you advice on your health. Please come and see me, and I'll give you great advice on how to be healthier and how to live a long time." And then when you walk in there, the doctor says, "Here, have some pizza and have some chocolate and just eat up, because this is the issue. Banks are supposed to be there to help us to save and be financially healthy, but it appears that they've sort of lost that mission. Which banks do you think are really sort of trying to change this paradigm? Are there organizations out there?
I think that there are. So, for example, some people may have seen the new ads that Prudential is running, where they're actually having social scientists talk about the benefits of changing how you spend and thinking about your retirement. I think there is a sense that, if our customers behave better with their money, yes, it will be good for our customers, and also it might be good for us in the longer term. I think the conversation is really just getting started. I think this is something that really only started to happen after the economic crisis, and companies and industries take a long time to change. So we'll see going forward the extent to which these initiatives are successful and lasting.
Now, we've got a lot of really cool technology, emerging on the scenes right now. We've got the smartphone, which has obviously taken off and has been a huge boon in respect to, basic things like banking. And we've got things like Google Glass and the ability to sort of deliver information contextually. So how do you think this layer of technology, the ability to serve data or, this rich overlay environment, how do you think that might help us, control our impulse when it comes to spending? Or what sort of tools do you see emerging that might help us on this front?
I think these, unfortunately, like most things in life, these technologies have the power to really, really help us and really, really harm us. So, for example, mobile advertising, when I'm walking by McDonald's and I've opted in to their messaging, they can send me a coupon for a half-off milkshake when I'm right outside the store. And I don't know if you're like me, but that's almost impossible to resist. So there's ways in which it can encourage us to spend more and perhaps be less healthy. But you could also think about ways the technology can help us be better with our money. So, for example, we've been talking to a bank about developing an app that, of course, people would opt into. But the idea is, given your credit history, if you buy this product, here's what it will actually cost you. And you see it on your phone right before you buy. So yeah, it looks like it's going to cost $200, but given your current debt and your repayment history, it's actually going to cost you $480. Do you still want to buy it? There's a case when we're hoping to develop this soon. There's a case where it could really help you see the longer term impact of your spending. But the worry is, of course, that people would look at it once and not want to deal with it and stop using it, right? So right. Like all things in life, there's still a battle to be won.
So there's a lot of psychology involved in this. When you're trying to change someone's behavior in respect to their spending, what's the psychology involved in that in respect to getting us to change these instinctive things we do, like buying that cup of coffee on a daily basis?
Very, very hard to change habits in general. The analogy I often use is with eating, because I think they are quite similar, where I can tell you and inform you every single day that you should eat healthy and you should go exercise, and you know that, and you know all the facts and figures, and every day we sit around and we eat pizza together. It takes real time and effort for people to change their habits. I think there's a lot of research suggesting defaults can be helpful. So if I encourage you to sort of automatically be better with your money, that can be better for you. For example, with 401ks, now often they're opt out. So you automatically, when you start a job, begin saving in your 401k as opposed to deciding whether to do it or not. Some of these behaviors that we have, where we have you at a decision point and we push you toward A instead of toward B, can really have long-term consequences. It still doesn't solve the problem where in the moment I just feel like having a coffee and I really can't resist.
So, you know, we've seen some improvements in respect to, or we've seen some developments recently in respect to mobile wallets. We have Google, we have, Square, other technologies like that, that appear to be making it easier to spend money. But, you know, in terms of that decision point, how can we make it easier for people not to spend, but let's say to save? You know, how do we create impulsive moments where you can make healthy decisions? Apart from saying, think about this spend and maybe it could be bad for you, what are some other positive, proactive things that we could do on a daily basis?
You know, it's a great question, and we've been thinking a lot about it as well. On basically, spending money is fun, and you get something good as soon as you do it. And saving money is horrible, and you get nothing for about 50 years. And the trade-off between those, it's just a no-brainer. Of course you're going to spend your money. And the question is there a way to make saving more fun? And the analogy that I use is, we know that saving stinks because with our kids, we have to make saving fun or they won't do it. And the notion of a piggy bank, why are piggy banks popular and why do kids like them? Because it's a pig and you're feeding the pig. And then you actually have to smash the thing to get the money out. And that suggests, it's a real microcosm of the problem with saving, which is that you have to make it fun and you have to make it incredibly difficult to stop saving. And none of the products that we have in the market now make saving fun or really make it that difficult to stop saving if you feel like changing your behavior.
Right.
So we've been trying to think about ways to make saving fun for people in order to make them kind of more motivated to do it. So you can imagine, for example, savings competitions between people, where a group of people sign up and basically if they save, whoever saves the most that month gets money from the bank for saving the most. Everyone would win. The bank would win because people are saving more and they have more capital. We'd all be saving more as well. And because I beat everyone this month, I'm going to get a free $25. These are the kinds of things we're thinking about. We don't know if they'll work, but these are the kinds of things we're thinking about to see if we can make saving interesting instead of just boring.
Fantastic. Well, that's a great note to finish on, Michael. Look, thank you very much for joining us this week. I know you're extremely busy, and we appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule and joining the Breaking Banks radio show. Thanks very much for your participation.
Thanks so much for having me.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
Our workplace is dynamically changing. How do you stay ahead of the curve with respect to learning and training? Tune in every week to The Future of Workforce Learning and Development with host Pamela Robinson. You'll learn about real-world strategies, solutions, and resources that will showcase these changes and keep you ready for what's next. The Future of Workforce Learning and Development is heard live every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Did you know that at the root of every business problem lies a communication issue? Communication Nation, a show that brings effective business communication practices to the masses, addresses a number of topics and talking points that impact your professional development, as well as business productivity and profitability. Host Jill Schiffelbein makes the theoretical tangible. Tune in each Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Be ready to become a better communicator with Communication Nation.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
So you're back with Brett King. I'm your host at Breaking Banks, and we're going to continue the happy and healthy money theme right now. We have with us Carrie Bergbauer. Carrie is a money coach. She works with Carrie, tell me a bit about the sort of money coaching you do and the sort of people you work with in respect to your role as a money coach.
Okay, thanks for having me. I work with professionals in New York and around the country, people who want to take control of their personal finances. So sometimes they're single, sometimes they're married with children, and it's people who for one reason or another feel in a money fog and stressed out about money, the kind of paycheck to paycheck living, even if they have a good salary. So what we work on is aligning their values and goals and actions.
Fantastic. So, you know, what are the sort of problems people come to you with? Is it the fact that they're not earning enough money, or is it more the fact that they feel like they should have more control over the money they've got?
Usually it's, I don't know where my money's going, and I have long-term goals for my life and for my family, and I can't seem to get there.
So where would you start with someone that comes to you with a problem like that?
The first thing we take a look at is what are their daily practices around money. So usually when people come to me, they have big question marks in their financial life, and we work together in sessions, and I give them assignments between appointments for various ways of coming back down to the ground with their finances and really starting to relate with the numbers and getting into the truth and reality about what's happening. So we focus on daily practices around money. So are they looking at their online bank? Are they tracking their finances? And another important part of our conversation is how's their self-care going? Because money is such an intimate and emotional topic. People have all sorts of ways of sabotaging or kind of acting out when they are faced with the reality of the numbers, which may or may not be able to cover their planned expenses for the month.
So what are those moments of truth that really help people or raise their awareness about the, I guess, those destructive things they're doing that are preventing them from getting control?
Well, what we do is a really proactive model. So it's about forward planning. Before the first of the month, we want to have a completed plan for all of their spending, saving, and earning in the upcoming month. And so while we can't control or predict the future perfectly, we do the best that we can to get accurate estimates for, of course, the fixed bills. Those are easier numbers to obtain. But then we have, you know, a lifestyle category, but line-by-line conversation about all of those other creative choices we make, whether it's, you know, eating at home or eating out, shopping, traveling, and any other periodic expenses that may come up. So people can know going into a month if they spend, save, and earn according to this plan and according to the exact like I said, income that's coming in, here's exactly how much money they'll have left over in their account at the end of the month.
Right. So, you know, we listened to Michael just before. We're obviously creatures of habit. You know, a lot of these behaviors tend to, you know, we get bad habits in respect to our spending. And, you know, it may not be necessarily fixed expenses that we have each week that are our living costs, but it's those discretionary spending moments where those bad habits keep in. Is that what you tend to find?
Yes, exactly. It's, you know, I think it's when people have some of the deeper things around money going on. For example, another conversation we have alongside with the practical organizational things around money are the emotions and psychology about money. So really slowing down enough and asking the questions to help people uncover why they do what they do. So it's topics like family history, under-earning, overspending, conflicts in relationships, and all of these things that can influence our decision-making with our money.
Fantastic. So we have a caller, Carrie. So Dave Birch has joined us. Dave, where in the world are you calling in from today? Are you home in the UK?
I'm actually calling from Woking, City of the Future. I've just come in from the deck to listen to the show, which is terrific, by the way.
Fantastic.
I hope you don't mind me barging in with a couple of points.
No, please.
People made such great points. I wanted to call in and just amplify a couple of things. Just two quick points, I promise. So one is the discussion about whether banks make more money from getting you to spend or save. Mm. I don't want that discussion to fall prey to American exceptionalism. You know, there's a very, very distinct structure in the U.S. because of the way interchange works, and in particular because of the higher interchange historically on signature debit. You know, banks were happy to try and incentivize in that way. But as interchange goes down on debit, then the amount of money that the bank earns on the money that you have in your checking account in order to make your debit card useful becomes more important. So in other countries where debit interchange is lower, the interest foregone on the accounts is already much bigger income than the debit interchange. So I just want to say it isn't necessarily the case that banks make more money by getting you to spend more money. That is true for credit cards, of course, but that's a different case entirely.
Right.
If I'm the bank and I can persuade you to use a credit card instead of a debit card, great, then I make more money. The customer gets more air miles, you know, whatever. So just make that point. But the more important point I wanted to make was this issue about the data.
Yeah.
When people are able to analyze the data from their spending, I mean, I do this in a very limited way with my Simple account, and I know you guys are doing a similar kind of thing with Moovin. So at the moment, I can get the data, which I didn't used to have with cash. Now, because I use my card everywhere, I can get the data which tells me what I've been spending my money on. But I don't know what to do with that data. I don't know how to analyze that. And I think there's a big difference between the kind of big data vision of the world, which says the bank is going to somehow crunch all this data and tell you what to do. And I think, especially what I picked up from your last interviewee, I think there's a small data version of this,
right,
which says if the bank gives you your data in a useful, usable, standardized open format, then you can crunch it yourself. You'll go get apps from, you know, different kinds of money advice. You know, I don't know, maybe there's a Suze Orman app or something, or, you know, you'll get apps which you download which analyze the data for you. So I think just making the data available to people will have some surprising result in helping people to control their spending. It's not, you know, the bank doesn't have to crunch that for them, if you see what I mean.
So, Carrie, do you see a role? Thanks, Dave, for calling in, by the way. Carrie, do you see a role in terms of these moments of truth we've been talking about and raising people's awareness? Because we don't get a lot of visibility on that spending when we're just swiping a card, and the only thing the
right
card is telling us is whether the transaction's approved or declined. But will this data, as Dave calls it, and as we were discussing with Michael in the previous segment, this small data or this rich data, you know, what role is that data going to have to play in the future in providing those moments of truth or triggers or raising awareness in terms of an individual spending so that they can get more control and awareness?
The way that people create a healthy and sustainable relationship with money is by having a personal conversation with their own data. So instead of allowing an algorithm or a computer or someone else, a formula, decide here's what you're spending on what, it's actually looking at the numbers yourself, at the same time being connected to your long-term goals. In other words, do I have enough money left over at the end of the month to put towards my travel saving fund or my retirement, et cetera, et cetera? And it's making that connection between daily spending and the big picture that helps people get more conscious about their money, but they have to engage the numbers themselves.
Right. So it's not just about that visibility, but it's about understanding the context of this small decision and its impact over time.
Right. And in other words, does this work? If I keep spending $1,000 a month on meals out, is that sustainable for me?
Right. So, you know, how do people respond when they first learn that things that they're doing every day that they don't necessarily, they're not aware of the impact of that. You know, what do you see as a money coach in terms of their response? How does it impact them? How does that awareness change their view of the world?
Well, I've seen the spectrum of responses to the kind of awakening or the lights turning on coming out of the money fog, as we call it. So some people get really, really inspired and into the tools and the daily practice, and they keep, you know, they move very quickly down the road of financial recovery and start having, you know, dreams come true, and it's like awesome. Other people get so triggered, upset, mad, they'll go shop in a blackout.
Right.
And most people fall somewhere in between, like, yeah, this is great, I have all the clarity now that I needed and hired you for, but God, it's pretty uncomfortable. I mean, it's a discipline. It's not the easier, softer way. It definitely takes something, but it's so much better knowing how your daily and monthly decisions are going to impact how it's going to look and feel at the end of the year, for example.
Right, but it then becomes an informed decision rather than sort of living in ignorance about why I don't have enough money at the end of the month or why I'm not saving.
Exactly. That whole forward planning model keeps people connected to their money on a daily basis rather than the old way, which is rear view mirror accounting, where you get the credit card statement at the end of the month and you're looking back at what happened. The problem with that is that it's too late to make any changes. But when Right. you slow down enough to be connected with your numbers every day, it's in that space and in that practice that you can make shifts to accommodate for any overspending or underspending that's happening in various categories.
So, you know, we've observed previously, and we'll get into this more in the next segment as we get Mo on to join us, but we've observed previously that there's a very small percentage of the population that actually budget. Because most of us aren't these control freaks. So, you know, what percentage of the people you're dealing with are disciplined like that? Or people who budget, are they not the ones coming to you? It's more the people who just don't have that element of control?
Right. It's usually people who have, you know, 20, 30, 40-somethings who have never had a budget, 50-somethings in their life. And so nobody taught them how. They tried for a while and had, you know, fits and spurts of financial inspiration at various times using various tools, but, you know, left to their own devices, they inevitably fall off and stop doing whatever they were doing. And so part of the coaching model is to keep people accountable to how they really want to be living and where they really want to be contributing. So whether that's donating money or having more money to travel across the country to visit an aging parent. It's really meaningful stuff that people can open up in their lives when they put the necessary attention and, you know, real nourishment into their own garden of money. So you don't have to be type A or disciplined in order for this to work. But basically, you need to have a vision for your life. And then, you know, it's about being open-minded and willing to try a few new things to help you achieve your goals.
Okay, so we've got about a minute before the break. So just quickly, you know, how much help do you expect that, you know, financial institutions should play in this role of helping people with their money, giving them advice that actually helps them save?
Well, I think it's definitely missing. I am another person who's frustrated with my own, you know, choice in banking institutions. So I'm looking for a better, healthier, more modern, you know, savvy kind of model and user experience. I find that most institutions, what they provide is just static. So like the caller said, so I have this data, now what? I think the education that needs to happen is giving people questions to ask themselves in order to have, again, that inner conversation where they can analyze their own spending and earning and see how it's connected to the big picture in order to take the necessary action to have more of what they want.
Great, great. So, Carrie, I hope you can stick around after the break. What we're going to do is we're going to have a bit of a discussion. I'd like you to sort of think about the future and how this is all going to work out in 5 to 10 years' time. We always like to get a bit futuristic at the on the last segment. We're going to have Mo Khalil from Movin join us as well. So can you stick around after the break and continue the chat?
Yep, great.
Absolutely. So you're with Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We'll be right back after this break.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network. In sales, are you a lion or a vulture? Lions don't wait, they just go for it. Vultures hang around until the lions are finished and just pick up the scraps. How can you set yourself apart as a lion? Join the other aspiring sales lions and listen to Forget Patience, Let's Sell Something with host Ty Maynor. You'll learn the tips and strategies of top sales professionals. You'll gain more clients at a faster rate and at higher margins. If you're a sales professional, business owner, or executive, listen in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel.
We spend 70% of our week in the office. What is the difference between enjoying your job and enduring it? The number one motivator is a positive work environment. And that's where Real Recognition Radio comes in. Join your hosts, Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown, as they take a look at the positive factors of the workplace, such as employee rewards, recognition, incentives, and much more. Tune in to Real Recognition Radio. Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We've had Carrie, a New York money coach, on, and we've also got joining us now Mo Khalil. Mo is the chief data scientist for Movin. Mo, do you want to say hello to the crowd out there?
Hi, everybody. Good to be here.
So what I wanted to talk about with you guys is taking into account the data, the insights, and all of this amazing, you know, these improvements in technology we've got right now. You know, what is it going to be like in 5 to 10 years' time in terms of our ability to deliver these insights, these moments of truth, to our customers? Maybe, you know, Carrie, as a coach, how is technology going to, you know, how is it helping you now connect with your clients, and how do you think that's going to influence those insight moments in the future as well?
Technology helps me with my clients now because I have a lot of appointments by Skype with shared screen technology where we can look at the same document and tools and manipulate them and collaborate like that. So that's been extremely powerful. Not to mention a simple banking tracking app where people can, you know, have an ongoing record of what they're doing and transfers they're making, deposits, withdrawals, and all of that on the go is amazing. I think the best thing that will come in 5 to 10 years is the ability to control distraction, where so much overspending and regret and remorse occurs for people is in one-click shopping and online, you know, social deals and the countdown things, and being able to somehow design your own technology experience when you choose to have screen time and filtering out those temptations, that will help. And then I'd love to hear more from Mo, too. I've had a conversation with him before. Part of what you guys are working on is a comprehensive financial tracking app and program that really will allow you to have a type of money coach in your pocket. And right. So with more of the psychology feedback built into the transaction moments. So
Mo, from a behavioral perspective and, you know, from a data perspective, what's the sort of data as a data scientist that you look for to be able to give those moments of truth to a customer so that as they're transacting, they're suddenly going to go, wow, you know, I had no idea, and this means, you know, I should do this, or I should change my habits, or, you know, just raises that awareness or give them that control that Carrie is talking about.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is taking the existing data set and simplifying it, right? So we are, you know, looking at ways to present the standard information that allow users to understand their context. And so it's identifying what are the appropriate points of context that need to be raised to the consumer, doing a lot of predictive analytics around figuring out, are there indicators that can help the consumer understand the trajectory they're on? And I think that this is something that's been developed rather well. So if you look at Target, you know, they're able to predict whether consumers are pregnant just based on their spending patterns. And so you should be able to tell similarly for a consumer whether they're not, you know, on track or whether they're off track by looking at the spending behavior they've engaged in the past and leveraging insights that you've gathered from other users as well. So looking at all users on an aggregated basis, you begin to see patterns. So you can slot a consumer into that pattern and tell them you're exhibiting a specific behavior that may not be good for you. The challenge is, again, going to be finding the right times to present that information to them so it doesn't overwhelm them. And it also doesn't seem like, you know, everything is predetermined. They always have a choice, and it's just making them aware that the whole point of showing you this data in this context is to give you that choice.
Absolutely. So, Carrie, in respect to that choice, I like your idea of having this filter that you can sort of define yourself as a customer. In terms of that balance between, you know, information that is useful and gives you a feeling of control versus something that sort of flips to being more big brother, or like, will you just stop telling me what to do? Do you think there's a balancing act there? You know, where's the line to be drawn? Is it a matter of intensity of information, or is it how personal that information gets? That'd be really interesting to sort of have your thoughts on.
Yeah, I think that you're pointing to something that is so personal. And so anybody's financial wellness program or technology experience must be customized for their needs. So maybe they need feedback on shopping for clothes, for example. And so those totals and that transaction by transaction accountability may be more highlighted than, you know, other areas of their lifestyle where their behavior is more consistent and they're not concerned about themselves. When people come into money coaching, they usually have sensitive areas or places where they're afraid to look because they know that they're out of control.
Absolutely. So, Mo, you know, where do you think that balance is, or how do you think customers will be able to define that in the future with the technology we're seeing now? Things like, you know, better use of the smartphone. And we talk about big data, but this is sort of small, rich data, as we were talking about earlier in the show. Or things like Google Glass. You know, how are we going to strike that balance between, you know, so much information that it becomes a burden and the right information at the right time?
Part of it is that the user really has to opt into this. If you don't have the intent and the motivation to improve your financial health, then no amount of intervention is really going to help you. And so you'll find a range of users, some who will be completely open with getting as much information and insight and context as possible, and others who will want to limit that. Now, there are other ways to sort of help them gain comfort with that. Whether it's issues that they don't necessarily want to confront directly, but they might be willing to do so within a social context. So being able to tap into your spouse, your family, your friends to be the guiding voice for you. So you may not necessarily want to see the information yourself, but perhaps you'd like a simple update sent to your spouse once a week, and so they can have the conversation with you and let you know if you're on track or off track. So I think we'll come up with creative solutions for those who don't want to engage fully with the technology, leveraging the technology in just a very different way, where we can use sort of physical and the face-to-face in addition to being able to find the right ways and methods to present information to you, whether it's on your Google Glasses screen or whatever other device we come up with.
Okay, so just quickly, because we've only got a couple of minutes left. Carrie, we've got Aidan Davies, who has tweeted in to us from the UK. It's good to have a couple of UK listeners on today. And he's saying, you know, we've seen people who put their credit card in a block of ice, you know, so to stop them from using it. He said, what's going to be the equivalent of that control factor in the future in terms of technology? Would you have an opinion on that? It's a good one, huh?
Yeah, it is a good one. I think that the ultimate goal with finances is to keep it simple. So right. As much as people can pare down and merge accounts and consolidate things, and just it's that streamlining and alignment process so that everything they need to know is in one location, that's really, I think, what will serve individuals the best. It's the multiple accounts and credit card use that really tip people off center and keep them in the money fog sometimes for years.
Right. Mo, final thought, 30 seconds. What's going to help consumers the most in the future?
I think it's going to be the transparency and the control, the ability to see that information, to sort of emphasize what Carrie said, to be able to consolidate all that information, present it to you, and give you that opportunity to change your path.
Great. So I think that's a great way to wrap up the show. Thanks, Carrie. Thanks, Mo. The future is all going to be about awareness and control, and that's what's going to make you happy and healthier with your spending. That's what's clear. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Breaking Banks. We'll be back next week talking about more of the disruptions in the financial services space. I'm your host, Brett King. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.